Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. I've come across numerous stories lately that are both shocking and intriguing. The connection between nutrition and depression is a topic that's captured my attention because, after all, who knew that what we eat could affect our mood in such a significant way? Recent research has shown that nutrition plays a significant role in the development and management of depression. How, you might ask? Well, it turns out that people with depression are often deficient in several key nutrients involved in modulating inflammation, neurogenesis, and aspects of metabolism. These include folate, B vitamins, and omega-3 fatty acids. I'm going to be delving into this topic in this episode with Dr. Ids, a medical doctor with a master's degree in nutrition who is quite verbal on TikTok. He goes viral every time he posts, in fact. His TikTok and his brand is known for debunking the misinformation that is spread in the wellness space. But along with that, Iddy has a deep passion for nutrition and depression. So in this episode, we're going to be speaking about certain nutrients that are both protective for mental health, but then we're also going to talk about those nutrients that may be causing harm to our mental health. We're also going to be touching on the limitations of research when it comes to these two fields. We're going to talk about the gut microbiome, and of course, we're then going to be talking about the link between sugar and depression. So you don't want to miss this episode. I know you're going to get so much from it because I certainly did. This episode is sponsored by Ketone IQ. Feeding your brain correctly is absolutely essential for optimal mental performance. I'm not sure if you know this, but your brain cells require energy to work efficiently. And this energy comes from the mitochondria. So having efficient mitochondria is key to keeping your brain energized and functioning at its best. Luckily, there's a way to give your mitochondria a boost. And that is by consuming exogenous ketones. Exogenous ketones have been proven to not only increase mitochondrial biogenesis, but also improve the body's ability to burn fat more efficiently for fuel. So this means that taking these ketones as part of your daily routine can give you an edge on productivity and mental clarity throughout the day. For me personally, I've been supplementing with Ketone IQ from HVMN, and it's made a huge difference in my cognitive ability. It has a neutral flavor profile, so you can add it to anything without altering the taste. I highly recommend you guys trying it out. If you've ever wanted to try ketones, you've heard about it, you're thinking, oh, is it good for me? Is it not? You may want to be starting with this one, because I have to tell you, I've tried many, and this one is by far the best. So if you do want to try, just head on over to hvmn.com. Use code NEURO20 at checkout to get 20% off. That's NEURO20 at checkout for 20% off. Iddy, welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast. You have amassed a massive following on social media, mainly on TikTok, because you are known as the doctor who is debunking misinformation as it relates to science and nutrition. So I'm very excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So we're going to get things underway and talk about a topic that many people have most likely encountered, or they know somebody close to them that have encountered this, and it's depression. And I've dealt with many things in my research and in my field, especially as it relates to depressive-like symptoms. And I know that there is a strong correlation between nutrition and certain diets and depression. So I'd love to open up by first understanding, we'll take a helicopter view by understanding what depression is, and then we'll link diet and depression.
Yeah, amazing. So this is a topic I've been wanting to dig into for a long time, actually, because it formed quite a large part of my my clinical master's of research postgraduate degree, and really allowed me to understand kind of the broader context and nuance of this topic, right? So let's just start with tackling a little bit about what depression is and some of the misconceptions behind depression, right? So depression, or clinical depression, also called major depressive disorder, is very common, but it's a serious mood disorder, right? And I think people need to understand that it's not just feeling sad or feeling low. Like, everyone has periods of low mood. It's a natural part of life, right? But depression is more about the persistence of these negative and low moods that then persist for weeks and weeks. So where I'm from in the UK, to be diagnosed with depression, the symptoms must be present for at least 2 weeks, of which some of the most common symptoms include, you know, persistent low mood, anhedonia, which is a loss of pleasure in things you used to like doing, basically. Also fatigue and lack of energy. And then you've also got some additional things, like it causes severe symptoms that affect how you feel, think, and just your normal acts of daily living, such as sleeping, eating, or even working. Now, that's the umbrella kind of definition of depression. And we've got various subtypes and various manifestations of depression. And they can develop due to specific circumstances. So the main one we've already covered is major depression or major depressive disorder. That's some of the more kind of common depressive symptoms that persist for 2 weeks that typically interfere with someone's day-to-day life. So if it's affecting their acts of daily living, then we would view that as being depression. Then you've got things like persistent depressive disorder, also called dysthymia, which is a less kind of severe manifestation, but it goes on for much longer. So it's for like for more than 2 years duration. Then you've got depression surrounding pregnancy. And I know this is very common for a lot of mothers, you know, who may know someone who may have struggled with, you know, kind of perinatal or postpartum depression. So surrounding the time frame of, you know, pregnancy or after pregnancy. Then very common in the UK, I'm not sure about the US, seasonal affective disorder, which, you know, comes and goes with the seasons. It typically starts in early winter and it goes away like during the summer. And then we've got a really severe case of depression with psychosis. And being a medical doctor that's worked in psychiatry, I worked in psychiatry for several months. That's a very severe form of depression where a person experiences, you know, psychosis related symptoms such as delusions, or hallucinations on top of their depression, right? So those are some of the different types. But if we look at the general statistics surrounding depression, they're honestly really alarming. Like, it affects, I think, 5% of people globally, with over 800,000 people committing suicide every year, which is really, really sad to see.
It's so bad.
It's the fourth leading cause of death in 15 to 29 year olds. And geographically, unfortunately, I believe America comes out on top with the most depressed people, and China and Japan being the least depressed. So just looking at some of those statistics, you know, it's a real shame that we don't kind of have a tighter grasp on the factors and, you know, how we can empower individuals to combat depressive symptoms or maybe reduce their risk of depression. And that's kind of the whole structure of how I wanted to kind of go about this podcast with you now, is kind of, you know, providing some more of the context and more of the nuance. And then we can really kind of dive into how diet impacts depression. But if you don't mind, I want to quickly just make a kind of give a general disclaimer here. As before we dive into some of the intricacies, I think it's very, very important to state that whilst diet can be an important role in the management and prevention of various mental health disorders, including depression, right? I think there's a harmful narrative being pushed online at the moment that all it takes to cure your depression is to change your diet, right? And that could not be further from the truth. You know, a large percentage of my patients at the time when I was working in psychiatry, they had severe clinical depression. And I can tell you that it can get to such a state whereby people simply cannot wash themselves, they can't dress themselves, they don't eat, they don't drink. Even getting out of bed is such a struggle, right? And the only way you can treat them is through a combination of medication, intensive behavioral therapy, you know, support in their acts of daily living through carers or family and such. And if they're misusing alcohol or drugs, then they need support for that too. So when you have people online who perhaps don't have the clinical experience, who perhaps don't have the expertise, saying that, oh, you're depressed because you eat Lucky Charms or you don't eat fruits and vegetables, right? Not only does it shame the individual and make it seem like it's their fault they're depressed, but it shows a real naivety and lack of knowledge that there is no singular cause for depression. In medicine, we don't even fully understand the etiology of depression, right? We know various risk factors, but if the responsible factors for depression are unique to any given person, then why are people making out as if there's one underlying cause or one dietary cure for depression, right? It just doesn't make any sense. So I think understanding that context before we dive into nutrition and how it relates to depression is very, very important. Like, you will see a lot of this narrative, you know, that, oh, if you just follow this type of way or, you know, follow this type of living, then you, depression just doesn't exist. Right. And I think it's very important just to make it clear that that is not the case. It's a multifaceted, extremely complex clinical manifestation. And it takes an effort from multiple health professionals, you know, attacking the condition from multiple avenues to all come together to form an intervention plan. So that's what I'd like to say, first of all.
Yeah, no, that's really important, because what you're saying is you cannot entirely, or you cannot replace an SSRI when it's needed. And what it seems to me is that you're really saying that there are different levels. I don't know, you know, is there mild depression? Is there severe depression? Yeah. And maybe the mild depression is something that maybe you've experienced, maybe I've experienced, because when you said these things, you've got to tick off the boxes of, you know, constantly not feeling well. I know at a certain point in my life, then there has been a week that's gone by that, you know, I just haven't been feeling good, but it hasn't been in that chronic state. So you could say that they are what, depressive-like symptoms?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, it's normal, you know, it's normal to feel low. It's normal when something happens in your life that you weren't expecting or you weren't planning. You have a period of feeling low, right? The difference between depressive symptoms and having depression is when that period of feeling low does not go away.
Yeah.
Right. So even when circumstances in your life may change, you just, for some reason, you cannot get yourself out of that slump, and then it starts to affect your daily life.
Yeah.
That's when people really need to be seeking help, especially when it's going on for weeks and weeks. Right. That's where the distinction is.
So, okay. So then when we talk about nutrition, what are some of the key nutrients involved in having a protective mechanism against these symptoms or against the disease at stake? Or what are some of the nutrients that may be more harmful for us?
Yeah, amazing. I love this question, because I think it can be nicely kind of summarized by a very insightful and recent systematic review of 7 controlled studies that was done by Simone O'Neill and colleagues last year. And the title of the actual review is called Depression: Is It Treatable in Adults Utilizing Dietary Interventions? Right. And we're going to use this as the framework, as I believe it covers a lot of the major nutritional factors involved in improving depressive symptoms. So what they did was, they reviewed the effectiveness of lots of different types of dietary interventions in treating the symptomology of depression in healthy adults. Okay. Now, they looked at dietary patterns such as the Mediterranean diet, a low-fat diet where fat comprises less than 20% of total calories, increasing whole grains, increasing fruits and vegetables. They even used the Australian Guide to Healthy Eating guidelines, also individual phytochemical consumption, as well as, a lot of people might not have heard of it, but a high tryptophan diet, right? Mm. Now, that's a very interesting one, because in the study on tryptophan, not only is it an essential amino acid, for those who may not be aware, but it's also a precursor for serotonin synthesis. And because it's heavily involved in the regulation of mood and anxiety, low brain levels may contribute to worsening mental health. So tryptophan can't be synthesized by the body. It must be obtained through the diet. And some foods that are high in tryptophan include things like dairy, canned tuna, turkey, chicken. And it just so happens that these foods are also rich in B vitamins, which are also very important. So a deficiency in vitamin B12, for example, has been implicated in preventing, you know, brain atrophy and producing certain brain chemicals. But that also indirectly results in a folate deficiency, which is vitamin B9, which then leads to brain cell death, predominantly in the hippocampus region, as well as hindering serotonin synthesis. So interestingly, patients that present with folate deficiency, depression has been shown to be the most common symptom. So I think that's a very interesting one. So including foods like that are rich in tryptophan, rich in B vitamins, including, you know, dairy, you know, like mature cheddar cheese and canned tuna, turkey, chicken, even things like, for the non-meat eaters, you've got things like pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds are quite high in tryptophan, I believe. But crucially, all the seven studies as part of this systematic review revealed a decrease in depressive symptoms, with only two of them showing a medium to large effect on depression. And one of those studies that showed a large effect was something called the SMILES trial, which stands for the Supporting the Modification of Lifestyle in Lowered Emotional States trial, right? So Dr. Felice Jacka conducted a 12-week control trial to assess whether a modified Mediterranean diet, and they called that the ModiMed diet, could benefit people with moderate to severe depression. And what they did was, the focus was to increase diet quality by supporting the consumption of the 12 key food groups. Okay. And what these key food groups looked to be was whole grains at around 5 to 8 servings per day. You had vegetables, about 6 servings a day. Fruit at 3 a day. Legumes, 3 to 4 per week. Then you have things like low fat and unsweetened dairy food, 2 to 3 per day. Raw and unsalted nuts every day. Fatty fish, rich in omega-3s, you've got 2 at least twice per week. Lean red meats, 3 to 4 per week. Then you had chicken, eggs, and a few tablespoons of olive oil per day, right? At the same time, those were the ones that were promoted. Then whilst reducing intakes of what they labeled as extras foods, right? So extra foods, which are to be not completely eliminated, but to be discouraged, right? And these are things like, you know, typical sweets like refined cereals, fried food, fast food, processed meats, and no more than 3 sugary drinks per week. And also they stated to keep red or white wine consumption to like no more than 2 small start like glasses per day. And what they found was, after incorporating this modified Mediterranean style diet, they found that around 30% of the clinically depressed patients in the cohort achieved actual remission in their condition. So their clinical depression had improved so much that it was categorized as in remission. And this is extremely insightful, because prior to this trial, it was kind of the belief, you know, amongst the scientific community that lifestyle changes can only help like mild or subclinical depression. However, studies like these highlight that even in severe or major depressive disorder, changes to your diet could make a massive difference for a percentage of individuals. So I think that's really important.
I think nutrition is very not misunderstood, maybe undervalued, because there's this wonderful diet. It's the MIND diet as it relates to Alzheimer's disease. And we know that just adjusting for diet alone with Alzheimer's disease patients, you can lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease by, I think, around 60% or 63%. Just by adjusting for diet alone. So diet is incredibly important for the brain. And okay, so you mentioned sugary drinks in there. So I want to focus on sugar and the consumption of sugary foods and sugary drinks and how that may relate to depression.
Amazing. Yeah. This was the basis for my research paper that I did during my kind of master's year. This is an interesting one, because anything surrounding sugar or like refined carbohydrates or refined sugars, you have to be very careful with how you phrase things. Because people will just, you know, they'll often hear like one sentence and then like run away with it and then like think it applies to everything else, right? So let me try and be careful with that, with as to how we phrase this. So there are a few plausible biological mechanisms for why there might be an increase in the risk of depression when you increase refined carbohydrates or refined sugar intake, right? So first of all, in the context of over-consuming calories or in an excessive caloric state, refined sugars can be pro-inflammatory, as defined by the DII or the Dietary Inflammatory Index, when consumed in large quantities, right? They can increase circulating inflammatory markers. This will increase levels of neuroinflammation in the brain, and it can damage the connections like in the brain responsible for regulating mood, right? Secondly, higher refined sugar intake is linked to hippocampal wasting or atrophy. And the hippocampus can be up to 25% smaller in depressed people. And part of the reason this occurs is because of sugar's effect on a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. And BDNF, we know now, is crucial for the growth and the maturation of nerve cells. So when you have a higher sugar diet, that's been shown to suppress the production of BDNF, which in turn damages the hippocampus, making us less able to regulate our mood. So a meta-analysis of 11 studies, I believe, in 2008 by Sen and colleagues found a strong connection between lower levels of BDNF and worsening mental health. And when they treated those patients with antidepressant medication, the participants saw that the BDNF levels increased and their symptoms improved. So that's like some of the first evidence we had that shows or suggests that BDNF actually plays a causal role in the initiation of depression. So that's a very kind of interesting highlighting point there, that typically when you're looking at the context of an overconsumption of calories, there are a multitude of hypotheses which could implicate, you know, excess refined sugar intake as being pretty, you know, strongly implicated in depressive risk. And there's also a case to be made for higher glycemic index diets, right, generally speaking, so a high GI diet, which can cause significant spikes and fluctuations in our blood sugar levels, sometimes leading to a temporary rebound hypoglycemia a few hours after the meal. And these fluctuating blood sugar levels have been hypothesized to be linked to cognitive decline as well as, you know, fluctuating mood states. So naturally, when, you know, I'm sure lots of pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic individuals would know what it feels like to have fluctuating blood sugar levels, right? And it's not the easiest thing to kind of maintain your emotional kind of tolerance and, you know, to not get irritable or you know, to not get a bit cheesed off or whatever. So that's another potential mechanism for why higher sugar intakes could increase the risk of depression.
It's interesting because when we speak about how exercise is good for alleviating some of these symptoms of depression, we often link it to exercise increases brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which helps with the proliferation of neurons and also helps in the hippocampus. It's just a wonderful growth factor for the brain. And especially when you talk about synapses, the brain has around 87 billion neurons, and each neuron having around 30,000 to 50,000 connections. So, you know, if you start to kill off these connections, it just makes the signaling harder. And we don't want that, because that's not how you have a healthy aging brain. So staying away from sugar, which is very hard. I got to say, if you're just starting out, you are somebody who loves to have sugar, it's very hard to come off it straight away. Have you had any incidents with your patients where they've had to cut sugar completely, or have you just taken it out like periodically?
Yeah, so interesting. That's why I try to make it clear at the beginning, you know, it's typically a problem in the context of hypercaloric feeding states, right?
Yeah.
So like I can't think of many scenarios in which I would advise a patient or client to, you know, completely cut off their favorite snacks or favorite treats, right? Because we know whatever dietary intervention you prescribe to someone, adherence is the single biggest thing to, you know, show whether it succeeds or fails. So imagine if you're just prescribing everything that they don't like and then cutting out everything they do like. It's just absolutely never going to work, right? So what I try to, you know, incorporate into many of my patients or any clients that work with me on a one-to-one basis is to try and incorporate, you know, how can we pair these treats with a variety of other health-promoting foods that can perhaps, you know, help moderate or perhaps help diminish some of the negative effects from the emptiness of just refined sugars with a very, you know, low or lacking in various phytochemicals or nutrients that are beneficial to us. Because part of the problem there is to do with, if a large percentage of your calories are coming from refined sugars, which are just pure carbohydrates, then you're missing out on the space of your daily intake that could be used for more beneficial ingredients or more beneficial nutrients, right? So it's not necessarily a feature of the sugar itself, but it's more a feature of you're displacing other potentially beneficial foods, which could then be protecting and preserving your brain, right?
Yeah.
So I think rather than cutting things out entirely, I try to, you know, focus on incorporating positive change in, and then over time we might see that the body just may not desire those foods as much. So I think that kind of that frame of mind for me, I think works better, works well. And it's kind of on an individual basis with people that I work with. So yeah.
Yeah. So everything that you speak about, you often put science before opinions. You're citing scientific studies and literature. Have you found that there's any limitations of diet and depression research when you're looking at these studies?
Yeah, amazing. So I think a very useful example to talk about is the trial that we mentioned earlier. So the SMILES trial, where they were looking at the modified Mediterranean style diet, right? So the dietary intervention was pitted against what they called a kind of like a social support group. So what they did was they put one group of participants, gave them a structured dietary support where they had 7 or 8 meetings with a registered dietitian across the 12 weeks, as well as they were given things like, you know, free food hampers to help them on their journey, you know, which encouraged participation in what we call positive adaptive behaviors, right? And that was to like prepare the food for them to eventually eat, right? So not only do they have contact with a healthcare professional, they've got human interaction, they're taking away some of their social isolation, as did the control group as well. So they try to control for that, it's fine. But we also know that increasing engagement in self-care activities and other positive behavioral and lifestyle changes are very effective behavioral treatments to aid in the management of depression. So for some people, you know, the action of chopping up some veggies, you know, organizing all your food on the counter, you know, just having it ready to throw in the pan, cooking, you know, like receiving free food packages, just even the sense of smell when you open the food, the sense of satisfaction when you complete the dish, you serve it up, you know, these are all extremely uplifting and mood boosting activities, right? And that won't be the case for everyone. Some people find cooking a chore, you know, it requires energy, effort, time. But it's likely that people with clinical depression may feel that the experience of making a nutritious meal under the supervision and guidance of a registered dietitian is most likely therapeutic for them.
Yeah.
So the point is that if that patient was to just have the meal magically appear in front of them on the sofa whilst they're watching TV, it probably wouldn't have had the same level of effect as it did in the study with all the additional activities and support surrounding the dietary change. So there are many other factors that need to be considered before we can attribute the total effect size to the food alone. So it's not to say that dietary changes aren't important, but we need to be careful about taking some of these study findings literally. So when you see, you know, 30% achieving remission in their clinical depression, there's always going to be some level of confounding positive effect when you start incorporating positive behavior change. So that's probably the biggest limitation that I've seen with a lot of these intervention trials, is that it's actually very difficult to design a study that controls for behavioral factors like this. Because in order to improve someone's diet, in order to, you know, improve someone's exercise regime, you're going to need to provide positive behavioral change, right? Because how are they going to do it otherwise? You can't just, you can't make someone exercise for themselves. You can't make someone, you know, eat a whole nutritious meal unless you're making it for them every day and serving to them like on a platter, right? So I think that's very important to understand. Like, whilst diet is important for people with depression, outside of medication, various forms of behavioral therapy, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, counseling, those are the most effective treatments. Then further down the hierarchy of importance, you have dietary and exercise modifications, which I'm 100% all for recommending to anyone that asks me. But we need to understand that, you know, if you're not tackling intensive behavioral counseling and support and therapy, these changes aren't going to exist, and they're not going to be implemented by the individual, right?
Yeah.
So that's very important.
Adherence is by far one of the biggest factors surrounding almost every disease state, right? If we know that there's a preventative lifestyle intervention, then why are we not doing it? It's adherence. And it's just hard, especially as we get older. As you're speaking, I'm trying to picture the pathological process of what's actually happening here. You mentioned some of the good, you know, the good foods and nutritious foods, and I keep thinking about the vagus nerve, or I keep thinking about the link between the gut and the brain. So is there a link between the gut-brain axis and depression? Is that what's happening pathologically?
Very, very interesting. And yeah, I would love to go into this. So let's just kind of simplify things for everyone, because the gut microbiome is some of the most fascinating, you know, like emerging field of nutrition science, I think, in the last 10 years. But simply put, so the gut-brain axis describes the kind of the interplay, or the two-way biochemical interactions that take place between the gastrointestinal tract and the central nervous system. And occasionally it's used to refer to the role of the gut microbiota as part of this interplay with the brain also, right? So as you said, you know, 87 billion neurons in the human brain, right? Interestingly, your gut contains about 500 million neurons, which are connected to your brain through nerves in your nervous system. And the vagus nerve is one of the biggest nerves connecting your gut and brain. It sends signals in both directions. And now what we're starting to understand is that what happens in your gut and the state of your microbes can send information along the enteric nervous system and can affect what's happening in your brain also, and then also vice versa. So let me make it clear, first of all, that we really don't know much about the gut microbiome or the etiology of depression. The research is really in its infancy, and it's only just started going into the intricacies of these topics. So when you hear anyone making confident claims surrounding the microbiome or depression, you need to understand that it's largely going to be, you know, hyperbole, and it's going to be, you know, marketing, and it's going to be largely nonsense. Okay. That's the first thing I'd say. How the microbiome relates to depression, in the sense, what we do understand is that there are certain bacterial species that tend to be more prevalent or more diminished in people with severe clinical depression. But then the issue is here, how do we know that other factors, whether it's stress, trauma, or something else, didn't induce these changes first, and then they just appear to be associated with depression, right? We really don't have strong evidence to suggest that the diminishing levels of certain bacterial species has a cause and effect on affecting depression outcomes, okay? So not only that, so we don't even have a consensus on what constitutes a depressed microbiome. So a systematic review in 2019 by Chung and colleagues, I believe, concluded that there's no consensus has emerged concerning which bacterial types are most relevant to depression. So anyone that claims the evidence is clear, or that we really know how to fix our microbiome to then fix depression, is really just, you know, using this kind of shock value tactics. That's essentially what it boils down to. But what we do know is that generally speaking, an increase in bacterial diversity is associated with positive health outcomes. And the way we achieve that is by consuming lots of different types of fibers from largely plant-based sources on a weekly basis, right? And if your gut can't handle that, then to really try to incrementally increase the amount of fiber you're intaking over time. So a lot of people, especially from a typical Western dietary pattern, they might find a drastic jump in dietary fiber, whether it's from soluble or insoluble fibers. they might find that very difficult on their digestive system, and they might have flatulence, bloating, you know, constipation, diarrhea, and it might just be not very pleasant at all. So the way that a lot of people can try to get around that is by slowly and incrementally trying to include these positive high fibrous foods into their diets, allow their digestive system to actually build up a tolerance and to build and grow these certain bacterial species that we know are consistently associated with positive health outcomes. And then over time, you can reach to a point where, you know, you're consuming 25, 30 grams of total fiber every day. And that needs to be consistent, right? Mm. So that's kind of what the current level of evidence that we have boils down to. When someone starts going into more specifics, it just frankly, like the evidence is just not there. You know, when people try to tailor, oh, you've got a deficiency in this bacterial species and this is how we increase it with this certain food, you need to be very, very careful with that type of messaging because the evidence for it is just not there, simply put.
It's making me question now the carnivore diet because you've mentioned fiber, you've mentioned plants, and they are very much of the bandwagon of plants have got toxins or plant foods are, I don't know what they say, but a lot of carnivores think that like plants are going to kill us. I wonder if there's any, correlation between carnivore diets and the lack of plants that they're having or fiber and depression.
Yeah, absolutely. So, So the thing is, you'll hear a lot of anecdotal reports from, you know, people of the carnivore crowd, people that have been doing, you know, an only meat diet, you know, having no plants in their diet. You'll hear a lot of them say, oh, you know, I've cured my gastrointestinal discomfort and my mental clarity is just so much better and, you know, all this blah, blah, blah. But what you need to understand is that a carnivore style diet is essentially a very restrictive exclusion-based diet, right? So it's a type of elimination diet that we use in clinical practice when people have very, you know, distressed gastrointestinal tracts. They have severe IBS. They might have some form of inflammatory bowel disease, right? They might have various autoimmune issues that their gut simply cannot tolerate lots of plant foods at once, right? So what they're finding is that people that switch to this dietary trend, they often have short-term relief, and they associate this short-term relief with positive health outcomes in the future. That's a very, very poor argument to make because no one can feel, you know, atherosclerosis emerging in your arteries. No one can feel carcinogenic processes happening in your bowel, right? These aren't things you can feel. They're things that develop over decades. And before you know it, it's going to be too late, right? So even though you might get temporary benefit, especially if you're someone that suffers with severe gastrointestinal discomfort, you might get temporary benefit by going to an all animal-based diet. But just understand that the long-term health implications are vast. They are extremely vast. And the way that one way is to work with a qualified nutrition professional, registered dietitian, medical doctor, in order to alleviate your symptoms first, go on this elimination style diet, and then slowly and methodically incorporate certain foods back into your diet, right?
Mm.
And that's how you mitigate some of the deleterious effects associated with long-term exclusion of plant-based foods. So that's what I'd say. Don't conflate personal anecdote in the short term with long-term health implications, right? They are two vastly different things.
So wrapping this all up, I want to know where your passion has come from. You obviously have a very big passion for nutrition and nutritional science. Is that something you've always been interested in?
Yeah, interesting. To be honest, even before medical school, I took a year out and I was approached by some family members, family friends who, you know, a registered dietitian who was looking to set up a nutrition course, right? And they approached me knowing that I was going to do medicine and I was kind of interested in, you know, health, exercise, all that jazz. And after I was kind of like, you know, designing some of the exam questions for them, I was doing their course. And then the first three kind of years of medical school, I really started to understand that, whoa, a lot of the global burden of disease we see in the Western world, you know, I think it's something like 5 of the top 10 leading causes of death in the Western world are entirely preventable, right? Through kind of lifestyle modifications, you know, obviously social and environmental, you know, lack of accessibility to food, the social determinants of health. And that just really highlighted to me that I wanted to kind of go down the path of, you know, more kind of preventative medicine and lifestyle medicine. And then when I decided to take an extra year out in between my medical studies to then go into nutritional research, that was when my passion just clicked into place. I was like, this is amazing. You know, this is not talked about enough. This about depression, nutrition, mental health, psychiatry. That was the whole focus of my year in my master's degree. And, you know, it just really opened my eyes to the whole field of medicine that I thought it would be wise to kind of, you know, almost pioneer the way, like lead the way into, you know, getting people to talk more about it and encouraging discussion and, you know, helping some of my colleagues like better understand some of the nuances surrounding diet. So yeah, that's kind of where it came from, really.
I love that. So where should we send everybody to find out more information about you? Is it TikTok? Is it Instagram?
Yeah, both, just the TikTok and Instagram. You know, I don't have messaging on TikTok naturally because so many people are there. But on my Instagram, people want to reach out. That's perfectly fine. You know, I post loads of videos on there. I think I've done something like more than 500 now over the past year and a bit or 2 years. So yeah, I try to kind of correct a lot of the harmful misinformation that's being spread these days and also try to affirm some, you know, positive and correct information as well. So yeah, I just appreciate everyone's support. And, yeah, if you've seen my stuff, then thank you so much.
Yeah, I'll link everything below. Idi, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.